Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where once again we delve back 45 years into the past to look at the anniversary of the New York City broadcast of an episode of The Muppet Show. Tonight we're looking at April 25th, 1977, which was the original broadcast of the American debut of Juliet Prowse, who was in production number one, and ended up being the final American air date of the season. When did she broadcast in the British season?
Also late, January 16th, which, if you give me a moment, I will tell you what number that was. 19. After Mum and Sean's and before Kay Ballard.
Talked a little bit last episode about the fact that we felt that the British order of operations was doing a better job of somebody you care about, somebody you might not care about, in order to potentially keep viewers. Whereas I feel like the American order has been much more of the, we think you don't know who these people are, but we hope you've got a viewing pattern at this point.
Although I will say, jumping kind of right in, that Fozzie's joke, opening joke in the opening, works so much better as a later in the season joke than as the first time you see this show. He can't even get through a joke because he's laughing so hard.
Hey, have I got an opening joke for you tonight? you're gonna love this. It's too good. Huh?
To introduce our guest.
If this is the first time you've ever seen the show, you don't understand that that's his bit, is he tells a joke here. I mean, it's kind of obvious, I guess.
That was reshot for this episode. Every time we see Fozzie, except in the Wild West bit and the intro to that, is reshot material.
No.
Yes. When he does the Wild West bit, that's original from the episode Fozzie. But Fozzie in the intro, and Fozzie doing Simon Smith and the Dancing Bear, and any other Fozzie material, and I'll tell you how you can tell.
Wait, so are you saying the backstage bit was original?
The backstage bit was reshot for
yes.
this episode.
Yes, okay, yes. I also know this fact, so we can get into that once it comes up.
Do you want to know how you can tell?
The voice?
The voice is key, but the eyes. Oh. Original Muppet Fozzie's eyes were flat, and revamped Fozzie's eyes are slightly curved. They're domed. There are other physical aspects of the puppet that change over time. They will, as we've mentioned, get rid of the wiggling ears. But we also see a mechanic of Fozzie's puppet that we've never seen before in the Western sketch in this episode, which I think they've even gotten rid of once they got to episode 3 of the series. So, yeah, the entire backstage runner that takes place in this is shot in order to match up with the original Juliet Prowse footage, but there are still certain things that you can tell that don't link. So this is not what was shown to the test audiences.
Right. But even though it was reshot, this joke still wasn't...
isn't a good introductory joke to the show.
And even though it was done later, that doesn't mean it was done 26th. Even though there were only 24 episodes in the season. It was still production order one. It was still, as we discussed in the controversy of, is this actually episode one when episode two was shot first? As we wildly speculated then, it still had to be picture locked at some point to make it episode one.
Right, and I don't know when that happens. In Brian J. Jones' Jim Henson, the biography, there's a passage about taking the show round to the CBS affiliates. And producer David Laser says, things didn't go well. They hated them, he states flatly. In Mandel's opinion, the pilots were too British and exactly what Gray didn't want. The two episodes were too talky, with an overly long opening credit sequence that Jim wisely cut down. So we haven't seen the original credit sequence the whole time.
Yeah, I have a description of that if we want it.
Yeah, why don't we do that right now? What did the original credit sequence look like?
There's a second shot of Zoot and Crazy Harry in the orchestra after the chorus girls verse.
Mm-hmm.
There is, besides the blue frackle, the chorus boys and the kick line were different and included Snake Frackle, an orange-wigged rock star pig, and a different whatnot creature. They also sang another verse. You'll see the strangest creatures on the Muppet Show tonight instead of it's time to raise the curtain on the Muppet Show tonight. A third kick line immediately following the chorus boys consisted of croaking frogs and clucking chickens and was punctuated by TR, who introduced our leader, Kermit the Frog. The female chorus made a cameo appearance performing an extra kick line, and Juliet sang, "It's very nice to be here. I'm pleased to say hello," instead of appearing as the...
Instead of it being, this is our guest star, the guest actually had a line in the song.
Yes. Kermit would introduce her, and then she would have come on, sang that line.
I'm very pleased to be here. Da 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 da.
Yep. Also, the Wikia says a clip of Wayne and Wanda singing You Made Me Love You was introduced by Kermit as an example of the show's offerings, so it would have gone even longer than that.
So not dissimilar to the Joel Grey episode where they have that line, some things that go like this, and then they have the bit from Comedy Tonight. That would have been a regular piece of the opening.
Yeah. Lots of differences, lots of additions.
Well, it says very specifically here that after they'd gone around, after they'd been told that the episodes weren't very good, that they went to the Drake Hotel to get drinks, and Laser basically said, you need to go back and re-edit the show and even refilm several Muppet sequences. Where that production takes place doesn't seem to be part of my surface reading of this biography. That kind of timeline is less essential to a biography of the life of Jim Henson, but it is indicative that this is a patchwork of the original material, the stuff that they came to as being, this is the stuff we do for every show, and refilmed bits that somewhere in the production schedule they said, okay, well, these are the bits that don't work, and this is what we need to fix in order to have it be a presentable, as you say, locked episode.
Mm-hmm. But there's also, as you said, when did you say this episode was in production?
The original production date was the week of January 29th, 1976.
And Joel Grey, which was episode 3, which had that half bit in the opening, was May 18th, 76.
Yeah.
So there's a good 5 months there for them to shop it around, rework things.
We will talk as we go through the sketches and discuss them individually. If there are any remnants that we particularly want to point out, have indications that they're part of a newer or later production, we will highlight that. So if you have decided to watch along with us, you'll be able to pay attention to the details that we point out, or maybe you'll have seen them yourselves. We'll talk about all the production episodes that don't have to do with the guest star. Then we'll go through the guest star's bits, and then we will wrap up by talking about statistics from the episode and then overall statistics from the entire season of the podcast.
And the show.
We'll then end with our 5 favorite moments and a teaser about when we'll be back.
So yeah, we already talked about Fozzie and his bit,
which is very similar to another episode where he also couldn't get the joke out.
But that was because he was going on too long about it. He was doing too much setup and didn't get to the punchline. This one, he thinks the joke is so funny, he's just laughing through the whole bit.
Mm-hmm. But I mention that only because when Gonzo comes out and does the striking of the O, there's an explosion. Mm-hmm. And you and I had a little bit of a back and forth during the Phyllis Diller episode, where, as I said, the problem with Crazy Harry pushing the plunger and there being an explosion is there's no effects of the explosion. And here we have essentially what I was looking for.
Yeah.
We have...
the mallet explodes.
And Gonzo is left blackened and sootened and generally reeling from the explosion.
His suit even looks tattered. His suit looks like it's been shredded a little bit.
So that, I think, gives me a reason as to why they didn't necessarily do it with Crazy Harry, is it's effectively repeating the same joke.
Mm-hmm. Then Kermit introduces Juliet.
And if that weren't enough, we've also got Manamana. Whatever that means.
But from this point in the future, we're all pretty familiar with what Manamana means. Manamana has been a sketch that was repeated multiple times, specifically on Muppets Tonight during the Sandra Bullock episode. She plays a psychiatrist interested in phenomenon, because Kermit says that whenever somebody says that word, the snouts appear. And it's a good bit. Sandra really leans into it. in general, it's also one of those sketches that people who know the Muppets know that song. Pete, do you know the origin of that song?
Of course not.
The AV Club in January 2008 was asked a question where a person wrote in saying, there's this song that I know I've heard someplace, but I can't remember where. And they decided to inform the public that while most people are probably familiar with this song because of the Muppets, in fact, took it from a 1968 Italian film called, in translation, Sweden, Hell or Heaven, which was a fake documentary sexploitation film about how wild and crazy Sweden is. That was made a year after Sweden itself had produced a fake travelogue that's fairly well known called I Am Curious Yellow. This is a porn soundtrack. The scene that this originally plays over in the 1968 Italian film is a topless sauna scene, according to Keith Phipps. And I can't speculate as to where the Muppeteers ran across this, but somebody heard this soundtrack. And much in the way in which they did with Java and various other jazz tracks, they heard a narrative in it. And the narrative turned into, there's somebody scatting, and there's somebody who's annoyed at the fact that they're going off from the main theme of the song. But my enjoyment of Menomina has increased tenfold since 2008. Whenever I see it, and I'm just like, yep. This is a porn soundtrack that we got some happy Muppets dancing along to.
Yeah. We've talked a lot on this podcast about how I've forgotten things. Mm. I never remember the end of this sketch. For me, it ends when he runs from the back of the stage to the front.
With the drum going...
Phenomena! I never remember he leaves... He leaves the stage, leaves backstage, goes away, calls Kermit... Kermit brings the phone to them, and that's how it ends.
That's not how it ended in the original production of this on the Ed Sullivan Show a few years earlier. That didn't have that particular bit, so that's an escalation that they did, as is the drum beats. That's not in the original Muppet version of the reinterpretation of the Piero Umiliani soundtrack. So that's all them playing with the escalation of the bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm often surprised by that, too, because it's also not in the record album.
Oh, okay.
This song is on the record, and it doesn't have the phone call bit at the end of the track.
That may be why my brain is so locked in, because this was, as you know, big in our childhood.
Absolutely.
Our family would just have choruses of Menomina.
That's right.
In public. It was... fun at the time, looking back on what were we doing. My note says, finally the best Muppet Show sketch of all time. We finally get to talk about it.
From the first episode.
Yeah.
It's been hiding. But that I get. I get how this was something that they'd done on Ed Sullivan, that they'd road tested, they were happy with. Let's include this as part of the thing that we're showing how great the Muppets can be. This is how great the Muppets can be. It is, however, weirdly not dissimilar to, not Trap Flap, what's that was the original version, the You Are My Sunshine, Hugga Wugga.
Yeah.
It is not dissimilar to Hugga Wugga in that it's about somebody says you have to sing the song this way. It's not dissimilar to Java, where you have to dance to the song this way or else violence will happen to you. It's curious that that's the narrative they keep coming back to in their mostly silent alien Muppet performance jazz pieces is sing the song this way or else we'll get pissed at you.
And all three of those are very successful Muppet things that I love.
Yeah.
Like, as we've talked about through this whole series, some of the Muppet musical sketches just wash over me and I don't care. All three of those, great. A pluses. Also, I noticed for the very first time, Menomina's eyes are the same as the Snouts' mouths.
Mm-hmm.
They're just big yellow circles with, like, seen this sketch hundreds of times. Never noticed the eyes and the mouths are the same.
Do yourself a favor and check out the Ed Sullivan version of the sketch, because there's a little moment that isn't in the now canonized Muppet Show bit. where as Manamana is looking back and forth between the two snouts in dismay, he boops his nose into each of their open mouths in order to say, please? And then they are resolute, and he has to go back to singing Manamana the way they want it to be.
That's very good.
Speaking of not knowing what Manamana is, the end of the sketch, we have Statler and Waldorf in the balcony, where Statler asks, what is a Manamana?
And Waldorf says, who cares? It's all a bit. Then we go backstage to our first of the backstage runner. Scooter and Muppy want to do an act called Simon Smith and the Amazing Dancing Dog. Kermit tells them they aren't on the show tonight. Scooter says that his uncle came up with the act. And once again, Kermit buckles under the weight of Scooter's uncle's thumb.
Which is a pretty good indication that this wasn't in the first episode.
Right.
The whole uncle inclusion in this plotline, the whole Scooter inclusion in this plotline, is pretty indicative of the fact that this wouldn't have happened two episodes before episode 3, where both those aspects get introduced to the show.
Mm-hmm. Kermit is also drinking milk from a straw.
The drinking is fun. It's a good physical bit of Kermit calling out to the audience, think about it, I can't obviously drink this, but the liquid's going down in the glass. And is another moment of direct breaking of the fourth wall.
Kermit still isn't sold on Scooter's pitch, even though his uncle wants to do it, and he says so in very flowery prose. And then when...
But again, with a little bit of an aside,
it's to camera.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds, says the frog, displaying his artistic judgment, sappy.
Gee, my uncle thought it was...
It sounds, says the frog, displaying his will to survive... Wonderful.
Kermit says he's always thought of Muppy as a cute little fellow.
Again, he's just being flattering. He's just kowtowing to the fact that he has no power in this situation. He's petting Muffy in a very strange way because he doesn't really have the ability to pet with a floppy felt arm. And it doesn't look like petting. It looks like flailing.
Yeah.
But it therefore is even more entertaining when Scooter says, oh, that's funny. Muppy always thought of himself as a vicious attack dog, and...
As Muppy is biting Kermit. Muppy then finishes Kermit's milk as Kermit ran away.
Kermit then runs on stage to introduce the next bit, and the film stock changes. Now, that could have just been they were figuring stuff out, but it was one of my first indications that this had been filmed at a different time. So even though he's saying stupid dog...
That dumb dog, yeah.
And I think they wrote a bit in order to link to...
Because I know there's other changes. Oh, yep. Scooter and Muppy were the only characters who appeared in the broadcast version, but not the pilot. So there was a different dog at some point in this episode.
I think that this creation of a plot line in order to have it meld into that introduction is pretty good.
Mm.
The writers did a good job of coming up with something that would help patch over the production differences. There is one where they fail. Later.
Yeah.
But at this point, they're doing good work.
Kermit then introduces Gonzo, and Gonzo is going to eat a rubber tire to the music of The Flight of the Bumblebee.
The second of three tracks that's on the record album from this episode. This episode was very well represented. What's interesting is that there's more finagling of the production here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we ever originally saw Gonzo's full act, but he has a full uninterrupted act on the record.
Yeah, the Wikia mentions as such that he finishes the tire on the record.
But then there's a cut to Kermit standing in the wings saying, looks like another wipeout for Gonzo. And Kermit is mysteriously in one of the maroon felt suits, having just gone out to introduce Gonzo in his standard nudity. He is now wearing a jacket because he's wearing a jacket when he interacts with Juliet Prowse in the next scene. So we had to have him backstage different ready in order to have that scene match up.
So at some point from introducing Gonzo, he puts on a jacket.
Correct. In order for the next scene to match.
Yeah. Once Gonzo is booed off stage, as he tends to be, he calls the audience yokels and then spits.
Well, he has been eating a rubber tire.
Yeah. Which was my question. Is it tire he's spitting out, or is he doing, like, the disrespectful, I'm spitting on your name after saying it?
Yokels! What do they know about art?
It was hard to tell, but I assumed it was the former. the tire that is in the sketch that we see does not change while it cuts between Statler and Waldorf going from applauding to being disinterested in the space of three sentences back to Gonzo on stage. We don't see the tire disintegrate, but the tire that he's holding when he comes off backstage definitely has bite marks out of it. They didn't have flecks of tire in the puppet's mouth, but my assumption was...
But if he was eating it, yeah, he'd assume he'd be okay with it. Why is he spitting it out now?
Art, Pete. He has to suffer for his art.
Yeah, so we shouldn't spit it out. He should commit to
No, he's done. He's rejected the act. He's no longer going to finish it. The yokels don't appreciate it.
The Gonzo I know would finish the bit backstage even if no one else was watching.
I mean, this Gonzo is not... necessarily avoiding creature comforts. He's been told to get dressed in the alley, and he refuses. He dresses in a dressing room.
Is everything okay? Any complaints?
No, none whatsoever, except that I've never had to share my dressing room before with a man who eats a tire.
I told Gonzo to dress in the alley.
It's true.
It's not starving in a rain gutter, shivering, and going, it's all worth it!
But we'll
get to that.
We don't know about that yet.
But yes, after Scooter and Muppy come back out to further negotiate, after that point is when Juliet Prowse comes down from her dressing room. Mm-hmm. Is there anything about the Muppy escalation that we need to include?
Oh, that Muppy wants his own dressing room in star billing, because that sets up what's coming later.
Okay.
But other than that, no, there's no jokes there, really. And then Juliet Prowse enters, so we'll come back to that. Maybe.
I think we are going to talk about Juliet Prowse in the Juliet Prowse episode.
Yeah. After that, Kermit then does introduce Juliet, so we'll again come back to what she does next.
At the close of that sketch, we have Statler and Waldorf talking about the way in which she transitions out of the number by saying she just vanished, and that seems like it would be hard to do.
And Statler says, probably like this, and then he vanishes himself. It's a good bit.
We then have at the dance, where we have perhaps the shortest at the dance we've had, with only three quote-unquote jokes and one long extended reaction to the third joke.
As you've mentioned, this is going to be the last time we see George. He is not pogoing.
That's right.
So
he's starting and going out on a bad note.
Although there's logic for why he's not pogoing.
It's true.
Because the joke is that Mildred says that she feels like she's been gliding this whole time.
Her feet haven't touched the ground.
And George says, because you've been standing on mine. So he can't be pogoing because she's standing on his feet. So I'm fine with it.
Forgiven value of fine.
Yeah. However, George,
you deserved better.
Yep. And I'll miss you every day.
I'd just like to say there's a publicity shot from the first season of The Muppet Show that has Jim Henson surrounded by all the characters from The Muppet Show, and it's very early Piggy. We see Piggy later in this episode where it's early Piggy, and her mouth is very weird and confusing, but she still has her normal eyes.
Yeah.
In this, she doesn't even have those eyes yet. She's wearing a Piggy dress, but she has button beady eyes like any ordinary Muppet pig. And Jim's standing there in amongst all the Muppets, and Kermit's right on his right hand. And right behind Kermit are the glowering eyes of George the janitor. And he's positioned so perfectly to be sort of angrily staring out, being like, I'm here too. You definitely need to check it out in order to get a great angry George fix.
I love George. I didn't expect to fall so in love with George. And I know I've seen episodes later on in the series, but I don't remember them, obviously, because I don't remember anything that I see. But I'm going to miss George. Cut to three seasons from now when I've forgotten George entirely exists. You say, but what about George? And I go, who's George?
Well, we'll talk about another forgotten George later in this episode.
I don't know what you're talking about.
We're going to get there real fast.
Cool. Oh, yep.
But speaking of not Piggy, this is Richard Hunt voicing Piggy in this quick joke between a pig and Piggy, where she asks if the pig prefers Shakespeare to bacon, a rather traditional reference that comes up all the time in The Muppet Show. And I really don't think that a lot of people think of Francis Bacon as a wildly important playwright, and yet they just bring him up because of the pig reference again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. And he answers that he prefers anything to bacon. Because he's a pig.
Yup. The last joke is just as flat in that we have the female Muppet who frequently dances with Rolf dancing with a very wild monster that's voiced by Jim Henson.
It's listed in the wiki as being flower-eating monster.
Well, we don't see any evidence of that here. He instead asks, do you mind if I smoke? And even before she says yes, he starts producing vapors and thick white clouds of smoke like he's announcing a new pope out of the top of his head.
Yeah, she doesn't even agree. She just says, if you insist.
And then the remainder of the sketch is the cloud of smoke filling up the room and everybody dancing through it and him sort of saying, do you mind? Is this a problem?
And Mildred asks for the manager as it fades. Very good 2021 joke.
It's true. Every month I run into another article about people interviewing women named Karen saying, are you upset that your name has been terribly co-opted? If they had just called them the Mildreds.
Yeah, but no one knows a Mildred. Everyone knows a Karen.
Mm. The UK spot is Rolf doing a lengthy introduction to a song called You and I and George. And there's a bunch of patter. There's a lot about the idea that this is a song that is the song of our times. It's well-loved, except that nobody knows it. When they produced records of it, only two copies sold. He bought one.
George bought the other.
Where were you? Really great joke. He then continues to riff on it for a little bit longer before then singing the very short song.
You and I and George went strolling through the park one day.
Which is about a man, content warning, potentially committing suicide by drowning. And I wanted to know, Pete, is there a content warning on Disney Plus?
There is not. Also, logic issue.
Yeah.
If George drowned in the river, how could George buy a copy?
Correct.
Maybe that's part of the joke. I don't know, but...
No, I think they just ran with it and didn't care. The trivia track have an interesting thing to say about this song, which is, according to their research, it has no known author.
Hmm.
And this is speculated by the trivia track that perhaps nobody wanted to be associated with this song.
Does that mean that the show didn't have to pay royalties to anyone in order to use this song?
Well, the trivia track didn't do enough research. I found a fantastic column by a writer named Chris O'Leary, who goes by the internet handle Bowie Music on various things, because David Bowie covered this song in concert in 1990 and in, I believe, 1996, and traced back the history of the song to it being written by a man named Red Kelly, who was part of the Stan Kenton Orchestra. And they have performed it on at least two Stan Kenton live albums, including one released in 1959. This particular column about this was written in 2012, a couple of years after the DVDs came out. But the album was out there. And Red Kelly should be the author of note of the song, according to Chris O'Leary. And I have no reason to duplicate his research. There will be links in the show notes to the original recording. The Bowie performance in 96 is kind of hilarious. Like, he just whips out his guitar and sings it, and none of the attending audience has any idea what's going on. And he laughs to himself and says, I just wanted to do that. And then they move on to the next piece.
Yeah, because I clicked on it for some reason when I was watching the show and saw that information. So, take that trivia track. Wikipedia's got you dead to rights.
Well, the world, the interconnectedness of information has marched on.
Yeah, for sure. Then we have the talk spot with Juliet, so we will come back to that. After that talk spot, Waldorf calls for more, and Statler calls for less.
Classic Statler and Waldorf.
Then we have the third backstage segment. Fozzie enters and asks if his deep voice sounds like John Wayne.
Yep.
Okay, stand by for the Western sketch.
Hey, Kermit. Hey, does this sound like John Wayne?
Will you get on stage, Fozzie?
This is reshot because it's justifying why his voice is different in the next segment. Because Muppy is in that. Yeah. There's no cut there. So it's justifying the fact that Frank hadn't found his voice yet when that was originally shot.
Then we have the actual escalation of the Muppy bit, because this is where they come out with Muppy having come up with representation of how he wants star billing in the show, with a mock-up sign of them changing the name of the show from The Muppet Show to The Muppy Show. Now, I have been incredibly inconsistent about whether I refer to this particular dog puppet as Muffy or Muppy, and sometimes it's because I think I know I'm right, and sometimes it's because I just lisp the consonant and then run with it. But now that I've seen The Muppy Show mock-up with the letters, I will always at least be certain in my head what the name is supposed to be. However, listeners who have been listening to me say it wrong all this time know that that is the side effect of doubt. And my lips not being able to figure out the right thing to say.
Because you did say Muffy at least twice this episode.
Correct.
Knowing this information, we didn't, unlike this episode, we didn't record part of this episode 3 months ago and part of it now.
Right. I definitely started off this episode saying Muffy just because of bad habits, but knowing, as I said it, wait, that's wrong, I know that's wrong. Whereas previously, I've been saying it and being like, wait, I can't remember if that's right. But this is the straw that finally breaks the camel's back, and Kermit freaks out appropriately.
Kermit does his arms in the air wag as he runs to the stage, where he introduces Cowboy Time.
Rolf is a piano player in a saloon that does not look like a saloon. There's a note in the trivia track where Jerry Jewell talks about the fact in an interview that the British production team didn't really get American Westerns, and so they basically put swinging doors on an English pub and a cactus in the background.
Compare this to the pub bar in the Rita Moreno episode where she's dancing with the human-sized Muppet and just swinging him around. That looks like a legitimate bar pub.
That looked like, if I'm not mistaken, that was an attempt at a French drinking establishment.
Okay.
The human-sized Muppet, I think, has big mustaches, a beret, and a striped shirt.
Yep, you're right about that. But still, the level of quality from that bar set to this bar set is astronomical.
Yeah.
This is high school level drama flats versus a television show level of production.
This sketch also is a series of very strange, not quite successful jokes. It starts off with Fozzie coming in saying, "Reach for the floor, this is a stick down." Which therefore feels like it's going to be a satire on Westerns. But then the satire on Westerns goes very quickly surreal because he's holding pickles instead of guns. And they all make jokes about the pickles for a second until the pickles are able to shoot down the chandelier and blow up the bar. But then he continues with drawing more vegetable and fruit-based weapons out for the next two pieces of this. So it's not just I'm a cowboy, but cowboy stuff has been reversed. It's bizarre.
It was fun, though. I liked it. After throwing down his pickles, he pulls out a carrot for a knife, and then Rolf disarms him, and Fozzie says he's desperate and pulls out a bomb, which is an apple with a lit fuse for a stem.
In addition to an actual stem.
Yeah, yeah. The first time it was shown, I thought it was the stem. And then, yeah, when they go back to it, like, it's turned. And, yeah, you just see it's a sparkler stuck into the apple.
Fozzie says, "I have an apple and the fuse is lit." And then he realizes the fuse is lit, throws it up in the air. Rolf and he hug each other and it explodes. And this is where we see the mechanic that I've never seen in Fozzie before. Is that as he says, "The fuse is lit," the corners of his mouth turn down. So in addition to the mechanical ears, there was an additional piece of machination underneath the skull that allowed him to go from smiling to frowning. The trivia track points out that this made the head incredibly heavy, but also Frank, they claim, got to the point where he was confident enough in his puppeteering that he realized he could do it through the physical maneuvering of the camera angle and the general positioning of the head, that it would feel like it was emoting differently, and that they didn't need to do tricks in order to do that. But I don't think we see that in the rest of the season. I think that's the one time it's in existence, and I was kind of fascinated to see it.
Didn't even notice it.
I'm not sure I would have noticed it if not for the trivia track. Specifically, I can tell you I didn't notice it my first time watching, but definitely cottoned on to it the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Cottoned on to it. I'm talking about a Western thing, and I'm using slang.
What are you, I Joe?
I don't know what that is, so no.
Cotton Eye Joe.
Ah!
After the Western sketch ends,
thank goodness,
we have another Statler and Waldorf, where Waldorf says he always thought the Muppets were weird because they think explosions are funny. Hey, guess what? Explosions are funny.
He eventually agrees with you.
Yeah, because Statler has a cigar and goes to smoke it, and it explodes.
And then Waldorf says, I suppose some of them are droll. It felt very much an amusing bit on the page, because we've talked about how ending a sketch with an explosion is one of the things that Jim Henson thinks is funny. And so to have a Jim Henson-voiced puppet say, I'm not sure ending a sketch with an explosion is funny, and then to come around, felt very much meta.
Yeah. We then have a Juliet Prowse blackout sketch, so we'll come back to that. And then we have the last backstage segment, where Kermit won't change the name of the show. He's put his foot down on that. Because of that, Muppy doesn't want to do the Simon Smith act.
And we see the live dog that the Muppy puppet is supposed to look like run up the stairs and have the door shut, prior to Scooter saying that Muppy has refused to participate in the sketch.
Fozzie is backstage, and he wants Kermit to tell him why he doesn't have an act in this week's show.
But the Simon Smith number's on next.
I know.
What are we going to do?
Kermit, how come I'm not doing an act this week?
Congratulations, Fozzie, you're doing an act this week.
Which is the continuity bit that they don't fix. The switch from Fozzie saying, how come I don't have an act, and Kermit in full producer mode going, great, you're on stage in three, is exactly the kind of fabulous backstage antics I expect of the Muppet Show, but they needed a better line than I didn't have anything to do in this episode right after you've just had a Fozzie sketch.
Also, Fozzie did have an act in the original pilot that was cut, so at that point they knew they were cutting that piece, but maybe they thought it was going to go earlier in the edit, and then they decided to put Cowboy first.
Do you know if it was a solo act or part of a group?
It was a monologue.
Okay. Because there is footage from the trailer that CBS stations played in advance of this episode that's on both the Muppet fandom page and on YouTube, where you have a sliver of a sketch that was cut, where Kermit says, all cast members please get on stage, and Fozzie comes out and says, does that include me? And Kermit says, yes, that includes you, get on stage! And you can see that it's old Fozzie, and that it's Fozzie doing the voice that he does in the Western sketch. So there's a tiny little bit of extant backstage footage, which helps reinforce the fact that all of this was recreated.
So yeah, they're told to get on stage. Kermit introduces Simon Smith and his amazing dancing bear, now instead of dog.
Now, when you heard Scooter say Simon Smith and his amazing dancing dog in the first of the backstage runners, did you have the title of Amazing Dancing Bear in your head and go, wait, that's not right? Or had you forgotten this musical number and therefore it didn't immediately go, oh, I know how this sketch is going to play out?
Neither.
Okay.
I wanted Scooter to trip over saying bear instead of dog a couple of times. Because he just naturally says bear throughout this whole thing.
Right.
And if you've been practicing that...
And it's the rhyming word in the song.
Yeah.
You can't have a song called Simon Smith and his dancing bear and then rhyme a bunch of things if the song was going to be dog until 3 seconds before showtime.
Yeah.
It definitely puts the lie to that particular bit.
That was more my issue. Is performance-wise, I wanted him to fumble a little bit.
Got it. But no, he's fluid as the day is long because this was always going to be the bit. Simon Smith and His Dancing Bear is a Randy Newman song, which he had on his 1972 album Sail Away. Not that Sail Away.
Well, yeah, that sticks.
The song that came off that album that people might have heard is You Can Leave Your Hat On.
I was going to guess Short People.
No, different album. But the arrangement that the Muppet musicians have absolutely stolen from is not the Randy Newman number, but from a group called the Alan Page Set. And they had an album come out in 1967, and this is the note-for-note arrangement of that. Right down to the very specific saxophone, which is very audible in the soundtrack of this song.
Making the grandest entrance is Simon Smith and His Dancing Bear. They'll love us.
Won't they?
They feed us.
Don't they?
And Zoot is nowhere to be seen. You have just Rolf in the background, and yet you have very clear bumps. Where are you, Dave? Why is Zoot not in the background playing back-to-back with Rolf?
Especially because we just saw Zoot not 3 minutes ago interacting with Juliet, which we'll talk about later.
Yep. This is the third number that's on the record album. Mm-hmm. And so this song is in my head. And I was entertained to find out who had done it originally. The Randy Newman song is very different, lugubriously so. And I much prefer the jauntiness of the Alan Page and therefore the Jack Parnell arrangement.
Yeah, this is fun.
It is a little weird that the main action of the Dancing Bear is that they decide to replicate the realism of when you have a dancing bear in real life, you make sure that you've got a chain and a collar on it because bears are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first half of the song is Fozzie tugging at the chain and generally being hampered and maybe a little in pain until he then starts getting into the number and enjoying himself.
Yeah, he very quickly drops that and just starts performing and having a great old time. Statler and Waldorf reappear. They have so much to do in this episode. Statler asks Waldorf a question and in the middle of the sentence stops being audible, but his mouth is still moving. Waldorf thinks that the battery on his hearing aid must have died, and Statler then begins to laugh and says he fooled him again. Waldorf hits him, getting a little bit of a scrunchy face. Not as much of a scrunchy face as we've seen lately, but...
We then have the final musical number of the episode, which is Muppet Glee Club. And when I say musical number, I am overstating it somewhat, because I would say a full half of this is business before the song starts. In that Kermit and a number of Muppets, mostly frogs and chickens and pigs, have assembled in their maroon jackets, and he's going to conduct them, but there are two misunderstandings before the song actually gets performed. The first is that as he begins conducting them, they're just in awe of his prowess and are not singing, just standing there silently admiring the conducting. And then when he tells them they should be singing along with the conducting, they all start singing different songs, at which point he then freaks out and says, "We all should sing the same song. What's your favorite song?" And in unison, they shout out, "Temptation," which they then perform with Piggy as the lead.
They sing for 9 seconds.
When they're all singing and jumbling on top of each other.
Yep. And then Temptation is 1.77 minutes long. So almost the length of a UK spot, but not quite.
Temptation is from the singing team that wrote Singing in the Rain. But mostly what I was paying attention to in this, as I mentioned earlier, is that the Piggy puppet is constructed differently than Piggy will be in future episodes. And her mouth is a Cthulhu-esque hellscape that I couldn't stop staring into.
Neither could Kermit.
It's creepily weird and deep and dark and just not okay. I'm really glad that they rebuilt her because that was gross.
Also, a topic that we haven't had to talk about for quite a while, Richard Hunt versus Frank Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Hunt recorded the singing for the Temptation
But Frank Oz does the dialogue parts leading up to that.
Yeah.
So when you have a little bit of back and forth, when Kermit says, Piggy, are you going to do the solo? He calls her Piggy Honey, and she says, yes, my love, in response. So this is first episode, and that's therefore established that they should have a romantic entanglement from the get-go. That was square one material. But then when she does start singing, her amorous performance of the song seems to be more than Kermit is prepared for. Born to be
kissed, I can't resist. Well, yeah, she gets all up in his business. And as you said, that giant maw.
Yeah, with her weird squid orifice underneath her pig nose.
Be careful, she doesn't hear you say that, otherwise you'll get hi-yahed real good.
Look, I think Piggy is well aware that she's had some work done over the years.
Oof.
And probably also doesn't like to be reminded of her past self.
Well, she admits it in one of the episodes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think she would also be glad if there was no evidence of her former look.
Also, in the captions of this episode, Camilla's identified.
Really?
Yes.
In the Disney Plus version, when the chickens are singing, it says Camilla colon.
At one point, yes, Camilla colon whatever the sung line is, because one of the chickens gets an individual line.
Well, that caption is incorrect. The puppet is completely different.
Piggy can be different, Camilla can be different.
It's a fair argument, but I'm going to stick with the somebody is retrofitting history in a way that I do not accept. Also, those chickens who are singing are in ball gowns,
mm-hmm.
and the ball gowns go down to the floor like the chickens have long human legs underneath them. A further point against it being Camilla, because Camilla has normal chicken height legs.
Listen, Ben, she could have worked on her legs. Also, I like the idea that they just were walking on those dresses. That they are the size of chickens,
yep.
with the little legs are right there underneath it, but there's still 3 foot of gown underneath them, and 40-odd foot of grunt as well.
What's amusing about the length of those dresses is they're still not long enough to completely hide Richard Hunt. And so when Piggy tackles Kermit off the front of the frame, you can see his head in between the bottom row of frogs and the middle row of chickens peeking out in a gap between the dresses.
Oh, bummer. I missed that. I must have been writing a note or something at that moment.
I wouldn't have been able to identify. I just said Richard Hunt, didn't I?
You did.
I meant Dave Goals. The trivia track identifies him as Dave Goals, I'm pretty sure. And otherwise, I would not have been able to say, oh, that's Dave Goals. He doesn't look like the beardy version of Dave Goals that I'm familiar with from later seasons.
We then have the curtain call
mm-hmm.
with Juliet, so we'll come back to that. And then the last Statler and Waldorf bit is that Statler and Waldorf think that the show beats sitting at home watching television.
And then Mana pops up in between the two of them.
And says his name, /
catchphrase.
And that's the end of that. Thanks for making us feel bad about ourselves, Muppet Show. All right, Ben. So I have a quiz for you.
Yes.
The last quiz of the season. Let's see if I can come out on top. I don't know how I'll get points out of this situation.
I was going to say, you know what the point differential is. I don't. So
true.
Basically, you're saying we were close enough that you can come out on top, or you're lying about how much you're going to lose.
We'll find out soon. Question number one. Juliet Prowse's big breakthrough came as a politician visited the set of the movie Can Can in 1959. After seeing her dance, he declared her performance as immoral, bringing considerable attention to the performance and launching her into the spotlight. Which politician decried her dance? Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, Joseph McCarthy, famed communist hater, or Nikita Khrushchev, the first secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union?
Khrushchev.
That is correct. Question number two. Which big name was Juliet Prowse not linked to romantically? Elvis Presley? Frank Sinatra? Or Paul Newman?
Paul Newman's funny, as for something we'll talk about in the future. So that seems like it has to be the good guess. But also, you played the Frank Sinatra card so many times. I feel like that's what I have to guess. Frank Sinatra.
Incorrect. Paul Newman is the correct answer that she has not been linked to romantically. She and Frank Sinatra, the co-star of Can Can, were briefly engaged for 6 weeks, and she co-starred with Elvis in her next movie, G.I. Blues. And she said that during shooting of the film, they had a short and intense fling. Quote, Elvis and I had an affair. We had a sexual attraction like two healthy young people, but he was already a victim of his fans. We always met in his room and never went out. Question number 3. Juliette Krauss won Entertainer of the Year for her role in the musical Sweet Charity on Las Vegas.
Huh.
Which other Muppet Show Season 1 guest star was in that cast with her? A. Ben Vereen. B. Connie Stevens. C. Sandy Duncan.
Ben Vereen.
That is correct. Juliette said that Las Vegas was the most demanding place she ever worked. Question number 4. The bummer question. The 1980s were rough for Julia. Which of the following is not a tragedy that occurred to her during this decade?
Oof.
A. In 1980, while singing Fever at a Las Vegas nightclub, a fire broke out and 8 people died before it could be contained. B. In June of 1983, while filming an episode of Fantasy Island in Hawaii, she herniated a disc in her back, forcing her to fly back to Los Angeles for an operation. Or C. In 1987, she was mauled by the same 80-pound leopard twice within a matter of months. Once in rehearsal for filming a TV episode, and once promoting the airing of the episode.
Episode of what?
Circus of the Stars.
2 of those are true.
All 3 of them are true. 2 of them happened to her.
A.
Fever.
Correct.
Incorrect. She did, in fact, sing Fever at a Las Vegas nightclub. The fake one was June 1983. While filming Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Harrison Ford herniated a disc and was forced to fly back to Los Angeles for an operation. Yes, the leopard. She was mauled while rehearsing for the Circus of the Stars, requiring 5 stitches. And then in promoting the episode on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, she was on the panel with the same leopard, who then attacked her again, almost severing her ear.
Oh!
And it required 20 to 30 stitches.
No good, very bad.
Yeah, don't do it. Question number 5. Juliet and her second husband, John McCook, had one son, Seth McCook. Seth is married to Melissa McCaffrey, who worked as an editorial production assistant on which of Pete's, quote, favorite movies.
Okay.
A. Big Trouble. B. Saving Silverman. C. Sleepover.
I mean, I was going to say Saving Silverman before you gave me the list, so I think I have to say that.
Incorrect. Sleepover.
Hey!
The preface of that question I typed out for the last question of the season. Are you ready for the most Pete question yet? Yeah, so Juliette Krauss was a dancer, an actress. She never reached the heights of movie stardom that she expected. She did have a similar quote to another person who I did the trivia for that I can't remember who it was now. But she had a great attitude about it, being like, I can do lots of things. If this doesn't work out, I'll do this instead. And so that's one of the reasons why she started doing Las Vegas nightclubs, live shows, because her career never really reached those heights. But she just kept working, and she worked all the way up, basically until her passing in 1995. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 1994, and it went into remission, and she did a live review with Mickey Rooney in late 94, early 95, and then it came back, and she passed away in mid to late 95. Based off her IMDb credits, I think she was solidly in her I'm doing Las Vegas nightclubs at this point in her career, because she has a large gap from like 1972 to like 1980 where she's not really acting in TV shows or movies all that much, but she's in a lot of them as herself. She's doing like Match Game. She's doing all these appearances as herself, probably then promoting her live shows.
it's interesting for me to hear you say she was a successful actress and performer, because she really has a dance number where she performs fairly traditional dance, but doesn't then show the wider other aspects of her possibility. So she may have gotten better at being able to showcase the diversity of her talent, or the Muppet writers might have gotten better at figuring out how to get people to not be pigeonholed into their conception of who they were. But she is a pretty face that Kermit hits on, and a dancer, and that's really about it. They don't bring her back for a second musical number.
Yeah.
So the fact that she was an actress in Can Can, that she can sing, I'm surprised to learn that, because there's no evidence of the breadth of her ability in this episode.
Exactly, because besides the dance, she's backstage with Kermit as herself.
Yep.
She's in the talk spot as herself, and she does the blackout sketch.
That's right.
And the closing number as herself. She really doesn't do anything, quote-unquote, acting in this episode.
She's good, though.
She is.
I mean, we'll talk about the talk spot specifically, but in her first appearance, she's very fun. In the opening credits, I got a vibe from her then that this is an interesting performer, and it's too bad that the show really doesn't give her the full range of opportunities to play that. They gave Twiggy, who was more well-known as a model than an actress, more opportunities to sing and act than they gave Juliet Press. So clearly the mechanism of giving opportunities to public personas beyond just what the audience thought they were evolved by the second half of the season than before the season started.
I do wonder how much, because this was the first episode, like a band's first album is sometimes their best album because they've had 10 years to work on it. They put all their best stuff on it because they've been working on it for years and years and years. When this show first started, if this was kind of the idea, is like, oh, the guest stars will be a guest star. They'll be in one or two things, and the rest of the show will be Muppets. And as the season went on, it was more like, oh, guest stars are fun, and they breathe life into the show, so let's give them more. Also because we've run out of just Muppet things, so we need these live people to
juice the show a little bit.
Yeah.
It's an interesting theory. I can't agree with it or contradict it based on any information that I have.
Speculation.
I very specifically went back to both the Muppet Show book and the Jim Henson book for this episode in order to look for clues or indications about the transformation between the two pilots and the production season. And really, there's not a lot. The Muppet Show book, in part because it's not interested in pointing out what didn't work. The Jim Henson biography, because it's not just about the Muppet Show, and it's really about Jim Henson. And so it gives us that scene of Jim having to come to grips with what he thought the show was going to be wasn't what the audiences wanted, what wasn't what the network wanted, wasn't what the franchises wanted. And he had to readjust his mentality. But it doesn't bring us into the weeds of what they did to fix it, because they said, we know what the Muppet Show is after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Juliet and what she did on the episode. The first time we see her is, as you said, backstage. They do the matching to make sure Kermit is wearing the red jacket.
She comes down the stairs. We talked a lot during the
Valerie Harper.
Thank you. I always can start with Rhoda and then have to pause until I can get to Valerie. During the Valerie Harper episode, that was our first main backstage stair action. And so the fact that in the pilot they could do that, and then it went away for such a long time, is kind of astonishing. But also, I feel like they juiced the laugh track for this.
There's a huge applause break as she comes down the stairs.
It's massive, and
oh, I love her, Miss Proud.
That feels completely appropriate for a pilot. You want people to feel like this is an event, this is wonderful, and it only rings false because I know, A, that doesn't match later episodes, and B, I know there's no audience But I was impressed with how much they felt they needed to convince us that this dancer we'd never heard of was somebody who was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation with Kermit is he's glad she's there. He thinks she's great looking. She's wearing a black silk kimono. He's going to go get ready for her to be on. And then she, in turn, talks directly to the camera to say he's cute for a frog. The direct-to-camera-ness of it, I'm not going to talk about, but the through line there is established that it becomes about attractiveness and physical relationships, and that's what continues to be their thread throughout the rest of the episode, and that's kind of disappointing.
Well, she said he's sweet for a frog.
Sweet for a frog.
Not cute. So a little bit more personality-based.
When we get to the talk spot, the crux of that seems to be them establishing the reality of the Muppet Show. And that's not a bad thing to do in your pilot, in to address the frog in the room. That is really what this is best at establishing, is that that conversation in the talk spot should happen. That she's still a little weirded out by her circumstances.
Yeah, she is sharing a dressing room with Gonzo.
Who she calls a man.
Yeah. Yeah, because the way we know it's Gonzo, she says a man who eats a tire.
Right.
Oh, they also, hey, here for our segment of 45 years, I'll punch anything up.
Please.
Eats a tire works as a tire and also a tire costumes.
Mmm. There could have been good comic confusion there.
Yep.
Her dance number then happens, which is her against a black background with a series of green gazelle deer-like things dancing around her, with a highly stagey artificial forest done as a proscenium around that. The music that they dance to is Solace by Scott Joplin, and it's lovely, but I predict you hated it.
Yep. My notes say, it's dancing, so I'm largely bored by it. She's very good, I like the gazelles, but largely I just waited for it to be over. They do some interesting directing towards the tail end of it, where they do some different camera angles, and as we talked about in the Statler and Waldorf set immediately after this, she like runs towards the back and then vanishes into thin air. So the second half I was more into than the first half.
Mm.
Also, the gazelles do some more like flippadoos and spinaroonies and things like that, which were fun. The first part of it was largely more focused on interpretive dance, which I don't get. I'm going to be honest. I just don't get it.
I agree with you that there was nothing in Prowse's performance that I was particularly able to lock onto as a narrative. I'm a fan of ballet, but I think I'm a fan of ballet because I enjoy sitting there trying to figure out how they're telling a story with their bodies. Mm-hmm. Interpretive dance isn't a story per se, it's an experience. It's a
expression.
Yeah. And it's supposed to, much like, I'm assuming, nobody's ever said this out loud to me, but my assumption is that it's like abstract art. It's supposed to create emotions in you that you respond to subconsciously. And I've seen some interpretive dance in my time, some modern dance that has been non-narrative, and the only thing I've ever taken away from it is the physicality that these people can do is astonishing. But I've never been moved by it much in the same way that large splashes of Mark Rothko's color don't move me subconsciously beyond a technical level.
Mm-hmm.
So I like dance, but I like it because I'm impressed with what people are able to do. So I thought she was a good performer, but I definitely, while watching it, was trying to figure out, is there supposed to be a story here? I don't think so.
There probably is, because there's probably something to do about the tree forest background of the gazelles in there and her being in the forest and then vanishing away. I'm sure there's something there.
Well, let me say this. The subtitle of Solace by Scott Joplin is A Mexican Serenade. The music was used prominently in The Sting in 1973, as much of Scott Joplin's music was, and it was done with this style of arrangement where it was soft and gentle. There was both a piano version and an orchestral version in The Sting, but you can find piano rolls of this played by potentially Scott Joplin where it is jouncy in the way in which we think of Scott Joplin music being mm-hmm. very up and down and lively, which this was not. Nope. This was gentle and pastoral. But it didn't feel Mexican. And it didn't feel like it was doing anything except being a warm bath. So I would be surprised if there was something beyond a theme of the beauty of nature.
Yeah. The next time we see Juliet is in the talk spot.
Which I've been looking forward to talking about because it starts off being about it's weird to talk to a frog, it's weird to be on this show, but then very quickly turns into why don't you kiss me? And Kermit points out that some of the nice things she's saying about him could just be because of the power dynamic between a guest and a host. Except then they don't swing away from that. And I was sitting there going, this is creepy. They're even acknowledging that there are casting couch problems here, but then they still go forward with it.
I thought the misunderstanding was funny, though.
Which misunderstanding was that?
She calls Robert Redford quite attractive, and I think says that Kermit is the Robert Redford of frogs.
Oh, wow. Hey, listen, everybody. Did you hear that? Juliet Prowse thinks I'm the Robert Redford of frogs. Hey, you're going to be coming back on this show a lot.
Then he asks if she'd be willing to kiss the next best thing
to Robert Redford when she says she hasn't been able to in her acting career kiss Robert Redford.
You mean to tell me that Paul Newman is here?
I mean me, the Robert Redford of frogdom.
Which is, as you say, a cracking joke.
Yeah. Then we have the blackout, where Zoot points out that there is something strange about Juliet's feather boa, and it's because it's a Muppet, not a feather boa. That's it.
But she does a good shocked face, a good little piece of comic acting. I mentioned earlier that I thought her acting in the talk spot is good, and I do. If you've seen it already, you know what she's going to do. Just watching her react to Kermit's dialogue. She isn't necessarily 100% believable, but she never oversteps the mark. She never reacts beforehand.
She never appears glassy-eyed as if she's just waiting for her cue.
Yep. Because of she does not come back for a closing musical number, the last time we see Juliet is in the exunt at the end of the episode.
Well, that's the last time we see any guest star.
But no, normally we see one more time.
Right.
But yes. Her wipe is her last appearance besides her farewell. And this is one of the two occasions where we have
the tradition of presenting the guest star with their own Muppet.
We have a Muppet likeness of you right here.
Oh, how sweet!
Now, I know you'd rather have the cash, but...
No, Kermit, this is just wonderful.
Oh. Can I come home with you?
Well, of course you can.
In the Connie Stevens episode, I was pretty sure that Connie voiced both her and her Muppet. I'm pretty sure that Juliet Prowse is not voicing her Muppet here.
Yeah, that one's tough.
She does have a very particular accent.
It's South African, by the way.
Is it?
Yes. She was born in Bombay. Her father passed away when she was 3, and her mother, who I believe is South African, moved her back to South Africa, where she was raised.
That's interesting. I had assumed it was British, but that she sort of liquided in and out of it due to showbiz, but South African makes much more sense.
It's British-esque. Because, the first 3 years of her life were in England. Mm-hmm. She moved from Bombay to England to South Africa. So there's a mix of all that in there.
Dr. Henry Higgins could figure it out, but the rest of us are just going to be confuzzled.
I won't get that reference until February of next year.
Well spotted.
However, I get the reference.
Yeah. In the one line of dialogue that her Muppet doppelganger has, it could have just been a line that didn't have pronounced vowels that would have revealed her accent. or it could have been because it's by Aaron Oscar. My suspicion is the latter. But again, it's then just about appearance. Kermit says, "Your Muppet isn't as cute as you are," and the Muppet looks a little miffed, and then she kisses him again.
Yep.
Be better, Muppets!
It's the first episode. They have to start at a low point, so they can be better.
Yeah, not according to your first album theory.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, they definitely can and do go up from there, but not this season. It's a kind of a weak note to end on, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I thought that she was game, and I thought that as a performer who interacted with the Muppets, if she'd been given another opportunity to do something, I probably would have ranked her very high if I was ranking guests. However, since I'm not, I'm curious as to how you ranked her.
So there are 24 episodes this season. There's 24 episodes every season of this show. I ranked her 23rd.
Wow.
It's kind of a similar complaint I have to Sandy Duncan, which is she was good. She didn't have much to do. And because of my own personal likes and dislikes, I didn't like what she did. So, yes, I agree with you. If there was another musical number and she sang or was in an actual sketch, not as herself, I probably would have liked her a lot more, because I also agree, she was fun in the talk spot. One of my moments may or may not be Juliet Prowse related. But the big chunk of what she had to do was a dance, which I don't like.
Yeah.
So she got 23rd. While we're talking about rankings, you want me to go down the list?
Well, I'm interested in that we definitely had one empty slot in the top half of the numbers before, and you just put Juliet Prowse in the second to last slot. So I'm interested as to, A, if that just bumps everybody else up one, or if you have done a rearranging of everybody now that you can see them all in a row.
Well, I did not do massive rearranging. I may not be happy with where everyone exactly is, but I'm happy with the ranges that they're in.
Hmm.
So, yeah, sure, maybe Connie Stevens is better than Jim Nabors, but they're both where they should be in, like, the middle of the pack type of thing.
They're
just picked two random names.
They're both BB minuses, and therefore they're, while on a given day one might be 9 and one might be 10.
Neither one of them is going to jump to 3 or fall to 17.
Got it.
And I realized when I was doing my shuffling, 13 was the number that was available.
Mm.
So ranking her at 23, I was going to have to shift a lot of people up one. Except I had two people at 20.
Ah!
So I did have to decide whether Sandy Duncan needed to be 20 or Joel Grey needed to be 20.
Why don't we read from the bottom up?
All right.
Until we find out, by process of elimination, who the best guest in the first season of The Muppets is.
According to my own personal proclivities,
right.
Not anything objective. Number 24, Mummenshans. No one is surprised. Number 23, we just covered it, Juliet Prowse. 22, Phyllis Diller. 21, Harvey Korman. 20, Joel Grey. 19, Sandy Duncan.
Hmm.
18, Vincent Price. 17, Charles Aznavour. 16, Peter Ustinov. 15, Kay Ballard. 14, Connie Stevens. 13, Jim Nabors. 12, so we're at the halfway point, Twiggy. 11, Bruce Forsyth. Those birds doing a lot of work for him. 10, Lena Horne. 9, Ben Vereen. 8, Ethel Merman. 7, Paul Williams. 6, Florence Henderson. 5, Rita Moreno. 4, Avery Schreiber. 3, Candace Bergen. 2, Valerie Harper. And number 1, with a
bullet. Ruth Buzzy.
Coming in right at the buzzer. Ruth Buzzy. Couple of people stayed solid.
Hmm.
Ruth Buzzy stayed at number 1. Paul Williams never moved from 7.
I feel like Rita Moreno moved a couple of times.
Rita Moreno started out at 3 and then dropped to 5.
Okay.
Fever, inarguably one of the best moments of The Muppet Show. However, I'm I'm more of a comedy guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it fell as I found more comedic performances that I liked.
Well, you're a madman in some of those choices, but it's your list.
It sure is. Now, going back to stats for this episode,
mm-hmm.
before we do some more season-wide stats, this episode had 14.02 minutes worth of music out of 26.45 minutes worth for 53.01% music, which makes it tied for number one.
Goodness gracious.
Ethel Merman is the other highest number.
I would not have predicted that. That's a long dance number, then.
It wasn't. It's that there was a lot of interstitial music.
Hmm.
So the dance itself was under 3 minutes. It was 2.78. It was the longest piece of music in the episode. Menomina was almost 2.5.
Hmm.
But there was nearly 30 seconds of Flight of the Bumblebee. Cowboy Time. Rolf was playing the piano a couple of times during it. The Muppet Glee Club had two things. So music just came and went, and so I was having to constantly pause and get time codes for it.
No wonder this is nearly the bottom of your list.
But, Menomina, I said, one of the greatest things. And I enjoyed Simon Smith and the Muppet Glee Club.
Yeah.
And Flight of the Bumblebee. You can't be mad at Flight of the Bumblebee. There was one hit, 3 explosions, and 2 human Muppet kisses. For the season, I have some, not all of the season-long stats because my record-keeping changed as the season went on. I thought I had caught all of the nice nices and cute cutes in my notes throughout them, but in the back of my notebook, I have at least 10 cute cutes hash-marked, and when I was going through my paper notes and computer notes, I only counted 3 cute cutes.
Mm.
So I know that's not right, based off of those hash marks on this piece of paper.
This is the worst episode of Moneyball ever.
Yeah. Hey, I love statistics. I'm not good at my job.
All right, well, what do we have potentially accurate statistics on?
We have the length of time of music for the entire series.
Oh, add it up. Cumulative.
There is 264.19 minutes of music.
Give me that in real numbers.
4 hours and 24 minutes and 11 and a half seconds.
4 hours, 21 minutes.
Yes, because 240 minutes is 4 hours.
Out of
635 minutes and 5 seconds of show. So that is 6.5 hours. So 41.6% of the Muppet Show Series 1 was music.
I think I'm not allowed to do that, but I think that's statistically accurate. I think 41 was our most common number.
I've seen lots of 43s.
Okay. In my head.
Zombie. In your head.
41, it was the mean.
Yeah. So yeah, Juliet Prowse, Ethel Merman tied for
most amount of music.
Both percentage and
length.
Length, yes, because some of the episodes are a little bit shorter, but out of percentage and amount. I have numbers on hits.
Okay.
There were 216 hits in the series.
So that averages out to
9 hits an episode.
I mean, considering that we had 1 in this episode, we know that's not accurate.
Yeah, considering the Rita Moreno episode had 72.
Right, right. Rita's spreading the wealth out over the rest of the apps.
Yeah. Paul Williams, Twiggy, Vincent Price, Phyllis Diller, no violence. No hits.
Right, right.
Sometimes there were bites, didn't count those as hits. For explosions,
mm-hmm.
there were 44. Which is 1.8 explosions per episode.
I love 80% of an explosion. It's warm. It's not too hot.
Yeah. And
you can bask in it.
For kisses, human Muppet kisses, there were 15.
Hmm.
Kind of. With an asterisk. Because I still have the note of in the Charles Aznavour episode, there is an indeterminate amount of kisses between Charles Aznavour and Piggy.
That basically scrubs that number.
Yeah, so it's probably 30. Just double it.
Keep it in and double it.
Yeah. I feel fairly confident in my 1, 2, 3 dips. Mm. There were 9 of those, or 12 if you count the ones from last week.
the Boogie Boogie Boogies.
Yes.
Well, you know what? With 9, I feel fairly glad that I had you count them. If it had been 5 or fewer, I would have been embarrassed that I was wrong to bring it up in the first place.
They were only in 5 episodes, though.
I'm standing by my mental evaluation.
And for my final statistic, I have the results of the quiz.
Okay.
Now, Ben, we had quibbles about some of my bonus points.
In that you don't deserve any.
Well, maybe you'll be willing to give me them when you hear that we each wrote 57 questions. Out of 57 questions, Ben, you got 26 correct, which is 45.6%.
Oof, no good.
I, out of 57 questions, got 13.75 correct.
But if I took pity on you and gave you the extra 2 points,
I still would have had 30% of my questions correct versus the 24% that I in fact had with 0.75 of the 1.25 bonus points I should have gotten. Because I have
your use of the conditional.
Ben, I did bad. Give me something.
Pete, I recognize that you haven't been part of the Ed Biz, as Tom Lehrer calls it, for some time. But we're no longer allowed to give extra credit.
Ben, you should have just asked me for those bonus points what I got bonus points for.
And if you couldn't remember it, then you don't deserve them.
Yeah, well, guess what? I can't remember what they were for. So congratulations, Ben. You doubled my score.
Oof!
You had 26. I had 13 out of 57. So, you win. Congratulations. I hate you.
That is the correct note on which to end the competition between us. There's always the next season to start afresh, and we'll see if this bitter... What's the phrase from the Wild World of Sports? If the agony of defeat leads you to maybe start watching some Muppet movies and remembering who's in them.
Nah.
I recognize that the memory is definitely part of the problem, but the effort is the other part.
Ben, you've known me my entire life. I put in the minimal amount of effort into everything.
Unless it's a bit.
That's true. Yeah. Still seems like too much work.
Of course it's too much work. The fact that I know some of them at all is stupid enough. As always, we end each episode by going through our 5 favorite moments of the episode in question in order to leave on a happy note, unlike Pete's terrible, self-defining, disastrous score. I am going to start off with the 5 favorite moments by talking about a moment I alluded to earlier, which is in the opening credits, Juliet Prowse's introduction. And I really did feel that this brief silent moment, she is surrounded by the green gazelles from the dance number. And as she's smiling at the camera and they crowd around her, they start butting their heads into her face. And her face goes from, I'm smiling for the promo, to what the hell is going on? And the fact that they decided that that's how they wanted to introduce her to the audience, as somebody who goes from, I'm happy to be here, to I hate this, was such a wonderful comic moment. It trusted both in the show, that the audiences wouldn't be turned off and be like, what the hell is this? But also that she had a personality that could be real and weird in the show. It really gave me the opportunity to give her a lot of credit. And I think it carried through. I think I gave her lots of opportunities to be interesting on the show that the show didn't necessarily live up to because of that very brief silent segment.
I also had this bolded. This was going to be one of my moments that I alluded to earlier. But maybe we'll talk about this in the moments. This is by far my favorite piece of her entire performance because it was great. I do think, though, it kind of spoiled it for me that it made me think that she didn't really want to be there. Like, the...
Yeah, I could see why that would be a danger.
But also, the blackout sketch is the boa. She hates the fact that the boa is a Muppet. Mm. She didn't
want... Well, she's scared.
It was a similar face she made.
Got it.
At that moment. The first time we're introduced to her, she's complaining about sharing her dressing room with a Muppet. There were just all these little pieces that I saw as a run-through that she wanted to be there, but she didn't really like being there. And I think
she definitely wasn't prepared, I think, is her character arc in the show.
Which also, maybe that goes to show how good of an actress she is, that I picked up on this, and therefore I ranked her as 23rd. So she fooled me, and maybe she should be number two because of that. But I agree, this was splendid, and I loved it as well. For my moment, I want to talk more about Menomina.
Okay.
When Menomina is all the way at the back of the stage, he's muttering almost to himself. He's just quietly going... It's like he's forgotten that he's performing. And he's just like, oh. And then he realizes and runs back. But yeah, those quiet Menominas are some of my favorite things.
For my second of my three moments, I'm going to re-underline the joke in You and I and George. Before I get there, I'm going to bring up the fact that the piano playing, which I believe we've established in previous episodes, is done by Derek Scott, is great, but the puppeteering of the piano playing is amongst the worst I've ever seen. Again, it's one of those things that as you watch it over and over again, you get to pay attention to the things that you're not distracted by. But Rolf's hands don't match up with Derek Scott's very interesting jazz piano bar, I'm just sort of playing while I'm talking riff that he's doing. But I love Rolf's banter. Mm-hmm. I love his piano bar. I'm just going to keep talking until I eventually get to this song, but the song's not actually long enough to sustain the amount of introduction that it has. The balance of that sketch is wonderful. And the song itself is so weird. And as you pointed out, temporally impossible. But the setup of the joke of...
And it's only recording You and I and George sold two copies. I bought one and George bought one. Where were you?
It's the best two-camera moment in the entire season. And I laugh every time. The song in the sketch is so bizarre, but that at the heart of it really makes me happy.
I disagree with you saying it's the best to the camera moment, but I allow you to live your truth.
Do you have a better one?
Off the top of my head right now, yes. Kermit drinking milk from the straw. I don't actually think that's a better two-camera moment, but he does talk
to
the camera.
Is that
going to
be your fourth moment?
Not the talking to camera.
But the drinking?
Yes.
Think about this, friends.
Because before he talks to camera and says, think about this, I was thinking about it. And then he drinks from it three times, and then Muppy finishes it off. So it's not a Kermit thing. Mm-hmm. It's not something with the Kermit puppet. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously in the floor
it's in
of the glass.
Mechanism, yeah.
But Kermit's drinking milk. A, frogs don't drink milk. B,
he's clearly mammal curious.
Yeah. It's a feat. Mm-hmm. The whole purpose of this segment is to talk about puppeteering feats, things that make us laugh. And it's a puppeteering feat that puppets are drinking milk and not disintegrating because of cloth.
And that they don't have throats or lips with which to create suction, and so it's just a special effect. And they went through all that just to have a special effect and comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
As is traditional, to end a segment by praising Frank Oz being goofy, I'm going to end this segment by pointing out Frank Oz doing the Fozzie dance in Simon Smith and his Dancing Bear. So as they have an extended dance segment without any words, Frank has decided he needs to do some business. So he has Fozzie use his cane to lift the hat off his head and then spin it around. He then spins it off the tip of the cane and it goes away. He looks askance and then, out of nowhere, picks a scarf up from below camera and starts swishing it back and forth. And just as we come to the end of the bridge, his hand dips below the screen, and instead of coming back up with the scarf, he comes up with the hat that he has thrown away. And he looks at it for a second, looks at the audience, makes a face, and then goes back into the song. It's so dumb. It doesn't make any sense. The look acknowledges that this shouldn't and doesn't work. And the fact that they do it anyway makes me so happy. I've listened to this album so many times. I know this song so well. For there to be this stupid camera bit to elevate it as a gift to people watching it instead of just listening to it, it's going to make me want to re-watch this episode instead of listening to it. And that is part of the point. And that's part of the frankness of it all, that he's finding something to do in a moment where there's nothing else going on. He's making it happen, and he is glorious in that regard.
So, Ben, your top camera take moment only lasted one moment.
No.
Because you said he looks to the camera.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. The look to the camera is not the pièce de résistance of that moment. The hat magically reappearing is the dumb bit. The look is the confirmation, communication, but it's not the same thing.
Because there's another look to camera in that same segment.
Yeah.
When he takes the hat off with the cane, he looks at the camera and goes, like,
I did it.
I did it. And that's when he spins it and throws it off. And then all this happens. And yes, he finds the hat and looks again at camera. So I'd say it's two moderately good camera takes are better than that one camera take.
I don't think they're better.
Yeah, fine. I was just reaching for straws. I was reaching for hats. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Combs' Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast as Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena. I've been waiting 24 episodes to make that joke.
Nicely done.
I've known since I read this first time that was happening. So when you mentioned Sandra Bullock and phenomenon earlier, I was like, Ben, don't you...
If there are things, facts, names, dates, post-hoc reshoots, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben, and we'll see you next September when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 10, guest starring George Burns.
Yay!